It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll look at the relationship between famous writers and alcohol and the tumultuous history that goes along with it. First, this week, the Army Corps of Engineers released its long-awaited report that details options for keeping Asian carp and other invasive species out of the Great Lakes.
The report doesn't flat out recommend a solution, but provides a wide range of ideas that could possibly prevent the carp from entering the lakes. But some of the most effective ideas could take decades to implement and cost billions of dollars in the process.
Following the story for us is Chuck Kornbach. He's WPR's reporter in Milwaukee, and he joins us now. Chuck, welcome back to the show.
Good afternoon.
Well, this report has been a long time in the making. How did it come about?
Well, Congress ordered that the Corps of Engineers come up with some options for the interbasin between Mississippi River and Great Lakes. It came about when the Asian carp issue really started getting hot in the middle of the last decade as carp munched and clawed and swam their way closer to Lake Michigan to the point where they're close to electric barrier a little bit southwest of Chicago. So been in the making for a few years, cost millions of dollars to put this report together, and now here it is with eight options, basically.
At the moment, before we get to those options, what is the status of Asian carp in the Midwest and the hunt for them in the Great Lakes?
Well, generally thought that the carp have not established any reproducing populations or may not be in the Great Lakes really at all, at least the perceived more voracious ones like silver carp and bighead carp. The grass carp may be a little bit more developed in Lake Erie. But again, no signs of any developed reproducing carp populations, which could disrupt the food chain in the Great Lakes if they got in. But there's been signs of carp DNA surfacing, and there's been reports that some fish, not necessarily carp, though, have been getting through this electric water barrier near Romeoville, Illinois, southwest of Chicago. So all the signs are that the carp are nearby but not quite in yet.
What are some of the highlights of the various options that the Army Corps presented?
Well, they range from basically continuing current efforts like this electric barrier to things like special locks that would be put in. You know, there are some human-made canals between the Mississippi River Basin, the Illinois River, basically, and Lake Michigan in the Chicago area. There were plans, the options included putting in special locks, boat locks, in those areas to sort of flush out any carp that might be in the water around the boat and put in clean, treated water. And then there's the more expensive and more pronounced what they call physical or hydrologic separations of the two basins, basically piles of dirt closing off these canals, et cetera, either at the lakefront of Lake Michigan or sort of mid-system, as they say, in a ways from the shoreline.
In effect, that would return to the natural state of affairs, that it was an artificial connection between Chicago into the Mississippi River that united the two watersheds, right?
Well, yeah, the folks were digging around 100 years ago, shall we say, and altering what nature provided and sending treated wastewater instead of Chicago's wastewater going into Lake Michigan, sending it southwest towards the Illinois River. There would have to be some spend. If these big changes were made, there would have to be improvements in the Chicago wastewater treatment system if they were going to start sending all or some of their treated wastewater into Lake Michigan. So a lot of interconnected things here.
How much money are we talking about for some of those more advanced options, including that physical barrier?
Well, a little more than we make, well into the billions of dollars I've seen as the estimates. And the report the Corps of Engineers released this week had some higher cost estimates than did a report that came out a year ago or so from the Great Lakes mayors and another group. But both are talking well into the billions of dollars. But environmentalists in a news conference yesterday were touting that, hey, there's a lot of infrastructure spending goes on anyway for sewage treatment, roads, other big projects, highways, you know, the Dan Ryan redo in Chicago and so on, that these numbers are not necessarily all that big, especially when spaced out over 25 years, as it might take to not only finish the physical separation, but add some of these things like reservoirs and other things to prevent flooding.
Staying with the environmental groups for a moment, is there, I don't know if they've come out with a unified reaction, but are they excited particularly about one of these options?
Well, they are excited, they say, that the physical separation has been formally put out as an option by the federal government, not just the Great Lakes mayors, but the federal government agency is saying physical separation should be an option. They seem to be pretty united in favor of some sort of bigger physical separation like that. There are other interests supporting that as well. But that will be, as I say, have a bigger price tag and maybe a harder sell in Congress.
How about on the business side of thing? Are people, maybe especially in the Chicagoland area, happy about these options?
Well, and they say that the business groups also say the impacts could be felt in Wisconsin, other parts of the Great Lakes Midwest, and so on. The barge owners, tugboat owners, people, companies that use these waterborne devices, if you will, to ship, are saying, listen, leave waterborne commerce alone. That's a good option, don't cut into our business. Don't make us transfer coal onto 70 trucks, as they say a barge would, then put those on the Chicago area and southeastern Wisconsin highways. Depends. The Corps of Engineers, sort of in the middle, is saying, look, six of the eight options that we've presented would not disrupt in a major way ships.
There's been political dispute over this, I think legal dispute too, between states on the Great Lakes and I think mostly the Chicago area on the other side over the physical separation issue. Is this report going to change that?
Well, it will spark the discussion. You know, no one seems to be, you know, not too many politicians these days come out against protecting the Great Lakes, and not too many come out saying they're against jobs. and there would be jobs created by the spending on some of these techniques, some of these options. So I think the fight will be ahead might be how do you best create jobs and protect the Great Lakes and not saddle the taxpayers that might be concerned about some of this year after year.
So you got eight options from the Army Corps. Who decides and then who pays?
Well, Congress apparently will decide, and whoever is president, perhaps the next president, will just make some decisions on where to what to start doing. The Corps of Engineers says that you and I and all our listeners can influence the process now. There's public meetings are about to start tomorrow afternoon down in Chicago, Monday afternoon in Milwaukee. And we should mention for our Western Wisconsin listeners in the Twin Cities, Bloomington, Minnesota, on January 27th, because there'd be some changes for the Mississippi River as well. Certainly there are Asian carp in part of the Mississippi moving on up, not in huge numbers in between Wisconsin and Minnesota, but significant enough they make story, they generate news once in a while. So there's impacts for both the Great Lakes, Lake Michigan side, and our Western folks along the Mississippi.
I guess I should ask you before we let you go, Chuck, what is the damage if these Asian carp and the other species in question here do get into the Great Lakes? What's the concern about their impact?
Well, there's some debate among scientists about the impact. A lot of the scientists say there would be disruption of the food web. The carp would displace other more desirable fish, eat their food and so on. Others are saying, you know, they're water chemistry is a little bit different. Are there other ways the Great Lake Michigan is different than the Mississippi River system? Certainly Lake Superior is colder. But the political debate and scientific debate has largely been largely focused on it would be bad if especially the carp, but also these other species, some other species we're talking about as well, it would be bad if there was an easier way for the species to get from one basin to the other.
All right, and as far as timeline, you mentioned those public hearings coming up. Do you have an idea of when there could be a plan in place and groundbreaking on whatever it might be?
Well, I don't know. You guys had a discussion a little while ago about using drones. I think in 2040 or so, you might have need drones to cover the final ribbon cutting of something. It might take that long to produce a final decision. But, this sounds like there's a consensus to have a pretty good debate over the next year or two about this and then maybe make some decisions around 2016.
All right, Chuck, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Chuck Kornbach. He's WPR's reporter in Milwaukee.
Coming up next, a look at the relationship between writers and alcohol and why some of the greatest works of literature may have come at a steep price.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later this hour, we'll hear about the wintry tradition of the polar plunge.
First, we explore the link between writing and drinking. Authors like Ernest Hemingway, John Cheever, Raymond Carver, and F. Scott Fitzgerald lived hard-drinking lives that seem hard to untangle from their work as writers.
And we want to know what you think. Is alcohol somehow linked to creativity? And do creative types use alcohol to access parts of their creative self? Is it necessary? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Our guest, Olivia Lang, joins us now to explore the relationship between drinking and writing. She herself is a writer and critic, and her new book is called The Trip to Echo Spring on Writers and Drinking. Olivia, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, nice to be here.
Well, why has there been such a long association, warranted or not, between great writing and hard drinking?
I think it's partly that writers have liked to drink, and partly then it becomes a perpetuating thing in that once people imagine that that's what they have to do to be a writer, they carry on doing it, and that enables the drinking to continue as well, I think.
Well, there's certainly, once you start thinking about the writers who had alcohol problems, I mean, you could go on all day. You've got F. Scott Fitzgerald and Hemingway and Dylan Thomas and Berryman, and you just can keep going. And it seems like it's...
Yeah, there's hundreds.
Why is that?
Why do writers drink? It's an enormous question. I mean, like I say, I think lots of writers have just felt a need to have some sort of a prop. The idea that it's associated with creativity or that literally drinking leads to creative inspiration, I think actually that tends to be untrue. That's the sort of myth we have, is that somebody will settle down, they'll be at their typewriter, they'll drink some bourbon and they'll start writing. And that's really not that common. What I found when I was working on the subject was writers tend much more to use drink as a way of changing the channel at the end of a writing day. Hemingway wrote about that, say that it changes his ideas. He'd be working in the morning, he'd be quite stressed, and it would be something that would just let him relax. And then the other thing is the kind of people that writers often tend to be. There often tends to be a correlation with, not always, but often a correlation with things like sensitivity, depression, anxiety. And the drinking is used to self-medicate, to successfully in early stages, to sort of create some kind of protection, some kind of more agile social self. Over time, of course, that's a strategy that doesn't tend to work because alcohol is, as we know, an addictive substance.
Well, understanding the intersection between drinkers and writers was something that resonated in your own life. Why was that?
I grew up in an alcoholic family. My mother's partner was an alcoholic, and between the ages of about 8 and 10, it was a really quite chaotic period. It was quite frightening. And that just left me with a real fascination for the subject, a real sort of desire to understand why somebody, not necessarily a writer, why anyone drinks, and why this substance can become so desirable, so precious, that somebody will use it, keep perpetuating their use of it. Well, everything else in their life is falling apart. So we see, and this is something that comes up with all these writers, we see marriages failing, we see relationships with children failing, friendships falling apart, and yet there's still this desire to keep on and on drinking. So when I encountered the first book about alcohol that I read was Cat on a Hudson Roof by Tennessee Williams, and it just stunned me. It was like, here's this book that starts to get to grips with what an alcoholic family is like, with what it's like to live under that sort of spell. And from then on, I was just really fascinated in what writers had to say about alcohol, and also in how it worked, that there were so many writers who drank and managed to sort of talk about this subject that is always always hedged about with denial.
Well, you profile, you zoom in on about six or so writers, American writers. Tell us who you chose.
I chose Ernest Hemingway and F. Scott Fitzgerald, who are a real kind of classic pairing. And then I looked at John Cheever, Tennessee Williams, the terrific playwright. John Berryman, who's probably the least known of them all. He was an extraordinary poet, won the Pulitzer Prize, and very sadly committed suicide, like Ernest Hemingway did too. And then the last one is Raymond Carver, the short story writer and poet.
Now, why did you pick Americans? Is there something unique about the alcoholic American writer?
There are plenty of British drinking writers as well. There's Kingsley Amis, as you said, there's Dylan Thomas as well. But I think it's different in England, and this isn't the same. The sort of the overarching sense of it isn't really there. I think British people drink in different ways. And these were writers that I absolutely loved. These were sort of the people that I was most interested in, the people whose work I liked most. But it seemed from the outset that it was very much going to be an American story.
Well, there's a line in a country song that came to mind as I was reading your book. It's not everyone who gets drunk will write a good book. Is that what you found, or is there actually a connection between getting
That's
drunk?
That's a great line.
I know, I love that line. And maybe, I don't know, maybe accessing parts of the brain that might otherwise be closed down. Does that happen at all with writers, or is there no correlation?
It was interesting. When I was working on the book, I talked to all sorts of scientists. I talked to psychiatrists. I talked to neurobiologists. I talked to people who are working on the physiology of alcoholism and people who are working treating patients with alcoholism. And there's certainly things that alcohol does to the brain. It definitely suppresses brain activity, so it causes a sort of cessation in feelings of anxiety and stress. That's something that we absolutely do know. I think there's potentially a link between that and creativity in that it lowers inhibitions. But that's when we're talking about one drink. When we're talking about decades and decades and decades of hitting it hard, it's absolutely fatal to creativity. And I think we see that in all these writers, that their work really does suffer from the kind of drinking that they're doing.
Well, I want to talk in particular about some of these writers that you profiled. And why don't we start with Cheever? How did drinking come into play in his writing life?
Cheever is really fascinating. In a way, I think he's one of the most interesting because, for a start, he kind of created himself. He came from quite a poor background. He came from quite an unhappy family. He called it skimpy. It was not as sort of financially rich, but also it wasn't very emotionally rich. And he really didn't want to be that person at all. So he basically reinvented himself. He reinvented himself as this sort of waspy figure, quite well off, quite patrician. And alcohol was very much a part of that. It was very much a part of his ideal of this civilized life he was going to live. And this is the whole sort of drinking martinis on the lawn that we see in all his stories. And then the other thing with Cheever is that he was married, but his sexual desires were for men. He was very much aware of that and terrified of it, completely terrified of it. He couldn't really, he admitted it in his diaries, but he couldn't really admit it in his life. He couldn't see a way to that being part of who he was. And I think for him, the desire to drink was really something about just constantly trying to drown out or conceal or hide away from these desires and this sort of real self that he felt he couldn't accept. And I think often we see that with alcoholics, that there's something that they're trying to get away from or some kind of source that they're drinking that's very personal. And I think that was really the motor for his drinking, for his long alcoholism.
Well, I want to get a caller in on this. Let's go to Thomas in Ohoot Mountains. Hi, Thomas.
Howdy.
Hi. What do you think?
I was curious about the idea of alcohol being a vehicle for creation, as opposed to when you're an artist. I'm a visual artist, and the idea that you would actually need it for escapism or to deal with the fact that artists are typically marginalized, you know, components of society. So it's more of a medication, I would say, than using it for a creative vehicle. What
right.
do you think about that?
Thank you, Thomas. What do you think about using it more as medication, maybe self-medication like you were just talking about with Cheever?
I think that's very true. It's interesting with visual artists. I was I was going to include the poet Frank O'Hara, who's part of the whole abstract expressionist circle. So I was reading about people like Jackson Pollock at an early point in the research. And again, that's a whole scene where the drinking is absolutely out of hand. And it doesn't seem to be being done to get inspired. I think that's the myth. But it seems in actuality a way, again, of escaping from self, a way of handling long-standing conditions like depression and anxiety, which do tend to crop up a lot with creative people. So, I'd agree with that.
Thank you for the call, Thomas. We're talking right now with Olivia Lang. She's the author of the new book, The Trip to Echo Spring, on writers and drinking. We're exploring the relationship between alcohol and art. Did writers like Hemingway and Fitzgerald write great works of literature because of the alcohol or in spite of it?
What do you think? Is alcohol somehow linked to creativity? Or do you think it's a shame that maybe these writers would have done so much more if it weren't for the alcohol in their lives? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up next hour, we'll find out what goes on inside the teenage brain. Right now, though, we're talking with Olivia Lang about her new book, The Trip to Echo Spring, on writers and drinking, talking about the connection between good writing and hard drinking and the consequences that follow.
What do you think? Is alcohol linked to creativity or linked to non-creativity? Do creative types seek out alcohol for good or bad reasons? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can always post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Let's go to our callers now. We have John joining us from Rhinelander. Hi, John.
I think there's a biochemical reward for creativity. When you tap into the muse, you get an endorphin reward. It's part of our biochemical makeup. And your brain starts to race, and you feel this euphoria. But you have to come down at the end of the day, and your brain has to slow down. Like Hemingway said, reset it into a relaxed mode, and that's alcohol does that. It's a depressant, and it also tends to release euphoria and chemicals too. Problem is, once you've clogged up all your dopamine receptors and you've used up your dopamine by drinking, the next day you don't feel the reward again. You have to get enough sleep or enough exercise to reset, and it's a vicious cycle, and then it takes away your creativity.
It's an interesting theory. Thanks, John. Olivia, what do you think about that, that you get a creative burst, kind of a high, if you will, from creativity, and then you need the alcohol to kind of calm you down again?
I think there's definitely some truth in that. I think it's another myth, though, isn't it, that creativity is always a high. If you're a lifelong writer, artist, whatever, a lot of it is just hard work. It's not necessarily sort of great moments of inspiration and joy. They certainly come, but I'm not sure that they're there all the time. And I think alcohol is so addictive. It's such an addictive substance. I think there's truth in that sort of pattern, that it's being used as a way of changing channels, changing the tune after a day. But I think assuming that the creative life in itself is happy is probably the bit that I'm not quite sure is true. I don't think it always is completely joyful anyway.
Sometimes it's just grinding it out.
Sometimes it's just grinding it out. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, well, thanks for that call. And we go next to Terry in Green Bay. Hi, Terry.
Hi. I just have a few comments. I'm not sure if you touched on Hemingway's use of, I believe he used absinthe. Possibly.
He did drink absinthe, yeah.
Okay, and if he might have used that to enhance, as a second point, I'm looking at other types of recreational and non-recreational drugs and their usages in the area of jazz musicians, Miles Davis and Charlie Parker and John Coltrane, and how they might have gotten addicted to it, but over time it as the last caller was saying, changed the chemistry in the brain and actually enhanced certain elements of their playing. And I'll take my answer up there.
All right. Thank you, Terry. What do you think about that, Olivia?
Yeah, that's very interesting. I think there's a novel by Hemingway called A Sun on Horizons. It's his first novel. Well, it's his first serious novel. And that's absolutely awash with drinking. He wasn't drunk when he was writing it, but he was drunk a lot of the time around it. And you can certainly see the sort of influence of alcohol on the style. It's very sort of jazzy in style. It's around that same time. And you can see some of the things about The Great Gatsby and Tenderest Night, Fitzgerald's two greatest books, that there's something very drunken, intoxicated about them, and that there's something, they're doing something stylistically, I think, that's mimicking drunkenness. And that's really, I haven't made that connection between actual jazz musicians. I think that's a really interesting point.
That is interesting. I was going to ask you about Fitzgerald and Hemingway. They knew each other. They hung out together in Paris and in Europe in general, and they made life look like a giant party, and it was all of it completely infused with alcohol. And do you think we could have had those books? Could we have had Tender is the Night and The Great Gatsby and The Sun Also Rises? Could we have had it if they weren't drinking like that?
We might have had Tender is the Night a lot earlier if there hadn't been quite so much.
There's
drinking.
That. Yeah.
I mean, it's the beginning of their friendship is so joyful, and they're having such great times. The party seems so fabulous. And as is predictable, the party doesn't last. There's a real kind of come down, and it hits Fitzgerald first. Fitzgerald wasn't as good a drinker as Hemingway, if you like. And he died very young. His last decade was incredibly unhappy. His wife was in an asylum. He was lonely. He was finding it much harder to write because long-term alcohol does absolutely nothing for creativity. It's incredibly detrimental to creativity. Hemingway carries on a lot longer because he has an astounding constitution. He was really a box of a man. But when you look at, again, his last 10 years, he really was struggling. He was at the very end, couldn't write at all, and for the last good while found it extremely hard to write. Crippling depression, all of these are things that you see with long-term alcoholism, memory loss, inability to structure coherent thought, none of which is helpful if you're trying to write novels, because you need all of those things. You need your memory, you need your wits about you, and alcohol really has appalling effects on the brain.
And Hemingway ended up killing himself.
Hemingway ended up shooting himself in the head, yeah, which is just such a sad end. And I mean, there are all sorts of reasons for that. His father had committed suicide by the same method, and there's a lot of sort of familial depression in the Hemingway family, but part of it is clearly to do with the alcohol addiction and what that did to him.
Let's take another phone call now. Joan is with us from Eau Claire. Hi, Joan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
After I graduated from college, I did take some English courses later, and one of the courses that I took was the short story or short fiction. That was a one-semester class, of course. In any case, we did study Raymond Carver quite extensively, and I still have a Raymond Carver book of a lot of his short stories. In any case, in many of his short stories, it was reflective of the drinking life. Lots of drinking going on in his stories, lots of implying drinking going on in his stories, lots of crazy behavior. And there's one short story that I remember in particular, and I actually did a paper on this at the end of the semester. And initially, his story was very bleak, very stark, very hopeless. He rewrote that piece, and it was much more colorful and hopeful and encouraging. And I'm not entirely sure as to whether at that point in his life was after he had quit drinking or not. The name of that piece is, I believe, One Good Small Thing. And I'm just wondering if your guest has a comment on that. Thank you.
Thanks, Joan.
Yeah, I actually deal with that at quite considerable length because that's a really interesting thing. It's not that way around, though. He initially wrote it as a very positive story, and then it got edited by his then-editor, Gordon Lish, and this is just around the time that he got sober. The first version is so hopeful, and Gordon Lish didn't like that. He wanted the sort of minimalist, dirty realist Carver, so he cut it back and he cut the ending out and he made it a much darker story. And Carver found that agonizing. There's an extraordinary set of letters that he wrote to Gordon-Lish, and he was basically saying, my sanity depends on this. My redemption depends on this. You can't publish it like it. I need this sense of goodness, and I need to be writing about this sense of goodness. And Lish went ahead with it, and it turned out to be an incredibly successful. This is the book, what we talk about when we talk about love, which absolutely made his reputation. Much, much later, the original version, this happened to all the stories in the collection, and the original versions of them got published. And so it's possible to read them back to back now. And to my mind, I can see what Gordon-Lish was getting at, but Raymond Carver's originals are very beautiful things, and you can see that sort of growing back of his faith in human nature and his faith in kindness. And that, it's very moving. They're very moving to look at.
Now, we've talked a lot about sort of classic novelists, but do today's novelists starting out, do they still have that same relationship to alcohol?
I think it's really a 20th century story. I think they're much more puritanical now about our drinking. And I think the addictions now, it's funny, but I think it's much more sort of online media. We're addicted to Twitter. We're addicted to these sort of, it's similar kinds of escapism, but it's not so much about drunkenness. It's much more about our habits, I think.
Olivia, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a great conversation.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
We've been talking to Olivia Lang, writer and critic. Her new book is called The Trip to Echo Spring on Writers and Drinking.
Coming up, we'll find out why people see January and February as a great time for a swim in Wisconsin's lakes in the traditional polar plunge. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later this hour, we'll get inside the teenage brain to find out exactly what's going on in there.
First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. 85 years ago, Wisconsin began issuing driver's licenses. Ever since, earning one has been an eagerly anticipated rite of passage for teenagers. Today, high school student Joe Schaefer tells us how he learned to drive in Wisconsin.
Some people are brave. People who go cliff diving and fly planes and hunt rhinoceroses. I'm not one of those people. I've never even been near a rhinoceros, let alone hunted one. And to tell the truth, I'm still afraid to drive a car. From the beginning, I was taught to see the car as a roving death machine. During our many driving lessons, my mom would offer helpful advice. She told me to check the fuel tank unless I wanted to kill us both. After I put the car in drive, she advised me to take the emergency brake off unless I hoped to kill us both. She encouraged me to accelerate slowly unless it was my big secret plan to kill us both. Things didn't get any better when I met my driver's ed teacher. He was a scary, hulking man, so full of car accident stories that almost every class period ended with the phrase, "And that's how she died!" After driver's ed, Wisconsin law requires you to take one-on-one driving lessons called Behind the Wheels. The idea is to give students hands-on experience with trained professionals. That's the idea, anyway. In practice, it's more like an hour of aimless driving, making awkward conversation with an ex-gym teacher who's used to yelling really loud to get what he wants. During my behind the wheels, I had one teacher who forced me to stop for 15 minutes so he could get a sandwich. Then there was the one who had a loud phone conversation with his mom for most of the lesson. Another teacher took me out on the highway, put the car in neutral, and pulled out the keys. Such is the way one learns to drive in Wisconsin. Finally, it came time to take my driver's test. In Madison, where I live, it's almost impossible to reserve a slot less than a month away, so I chose to travel an hour to Dodgeville to take my test there. The Dodgeville DMV is in a strip mall sandwiched between a grocery store and an electronics store. My mom gave me advice the whole way down. Drive slowly, but not too slow. Keep your head down. Let the evaluator choose how cool the AC is. My examiner was a middle-aged woman. Unlike anyone who'd ever driven with me before, she was quiet. She asked me about the weather. She gently told me where to turn. Not once did she bring up our mortality. As I turned back into the parking lot after my exam, I was confident. I hadn't died. The evaluator hadn't died. No one had died. So, where do I pick up my license? I asked. The evaluator looked up from her clipboard. Not today. You missed the turn lane.
Joe Schaefer is a high school student in Madison. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This episode is produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org and find them on Facebook.
Now a look at a winter tradition in Wisconsin. With temps well below zero this week, it can be hard to wrap your mind around the concept of jumping into a freezing lake for a good time. But lots of people across the state have done it.
Joining us now to talk about the polar plunge tradition is Christina Harris. She's Director of Communications for Special Olympics Wisconsin. The organization is sponsoring several polar plunges around the state to raise money for Special Olympics. Christina, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on.
What exactly, first of all, is a polar plunge?
Well, a polar plunge is when people run or jump into freezing cold water to raise money for our Special Olympics Wisconsin athletes.
And how long do they stay there once they get in?
Usually it's just a few seconds. Most people like to get out right away. I definitely like to get out of the water right away when I'm doing the polar plunge, although there are some people that kind of stick around there for a little while. They don't mind it so much.
Do we know who the sick mind that came up? Wait, that's kind of judgmental. Do we know where the idea came from?
Well, actually, polar plunge events have been held all over the world for decades, really. The idea to host the polar plunge here in Wisconsin came from Alaska. There was a Special Olympics office out there that was hosting the event, and so we had some of our staff and law enforcement volunteers take the plunge up in Alaska, and they liked it so much that they brought it down here, and we've been holding the event ever since 1999.
So you've done several polar plunges over the years, it sounds like. Can you take us back to that first one, what it was like?
Definitely. You know, you're a little bit anxious at the beginning. You stand in line, not wearing very much clothing. they call out your name. You jump in. You lose your breath for a few seconds, and then you're just moving as quickly as you can towards the staircase to get out of the water, and then running to the hot tubs as fast as you can.
Yeah, let's talk about the post game here. What, you mentioned a hot tub. What else is there for the warming back up after you get out?
Well, there's heated tents, thank goodness. So usually, you know, make sure you bring a warm change of clothes that are sitting for you in that tent. A lot of our polar plunges, we have a pub available, so there are some beverages to warm up afterwards as well if you're over the age of 21. just, you know, having a cheerleading squad is always good too. Having people there to warm you up after the event is always nice.
So I'm listening to you thinking, okay, I still don't get why people do it. The after part sounds nice, but is there something, like, once you've done this, do you feel like, you know, is it sort of like walking over hot coals? You feel like you've really, you're jumping out of an airplane, you've really done something?
Yeah, I've jumped out of an airplane before, and I would say that this is a very similar type of feeling. It's one of those bucket list type of activities that you just want to check off, and afterwards you definitely have some bragging rights. I mean, people will come up to you and they will be impressed when they hear that you've taken the polar plunge. It's also a great way to kind of rinse out last year and just cleanse and bring in the new year with an activity like this. So it's a good way to start the new year.
The bucket list is supposedly things we want to do before we die. I would be concerned, and I think a lot of people would, that this would be the thing we do seconds before we die. How much of a safety concern is there? Are there people who are warned away from this for one reason or another?
You know, we have medical personnel on staff. We have volunteers from law enforcement who are usually in the water. They're all bundled up in like wetsuits, and they're in the water and they're there to help anyone out if they need help getting out of the water. Obviously, if the weather is really cold, if it's below -4 degrees Fahrenheit, or if the wind chill's below -10 degrees Fahrenheit, we look at modifying the event. We don't want anyone to get hurt. And that usually will mean maybe doing like a pinky plunge where you stick your pinky into a kiddie pool of water or stick your hand into the water instead.
I could do that, yeah.
So we look at alternatives if need be.
So you wouldn't have been doing that the last couple of days here in Wisconsin. No polar plunges.
Polar vortex, yeah.
Polar vortex plunge, maybe not.
Yep, exactly.
Well, what kinds of people typically sign up to do something like this? Is there a polar plunge type?
You know, I would say not so much. There are many different types of people that do the polar plunge. I've seen kids, you know, age 6 all the way up to adults in their 80s or 90s doing the polar plunge. There's really a lot of diversity. We have a lot of students that take the polar plunge. A lot of company teams get together. It's a really good way to bond with your coworkers. I've done the event with my coworkers before, and it's definitely something to talk about afterwards.
My brother did this once, and he wore a suit, like a cheap secondhand suit.
Okay.
And I know some people go even further with costumery for the polar plunge. What kind of things have you seen out there in the water?
Well, I've seen all sorts of things. I've seen the Wizard of Oz. I've seen the whole crew from the Wizard of Oz.
Not the witch, right? Because she'd melt.
That's true. She'd freeze. Yep. And I've been a mermaid before. We had a team of mermaids one year. Togas. That was the worst idea because you don't want to wear a lot of clothes when you do the polar plunge. Less is better here. And so the toga just kind of clung right onto you afterwards. It was terrible.
So yards of sheet, not a good idea.
Not a good idea. Yeah, less is better here. That's for sure.
If you're going to do one of these things and you decide, you put your mind to it, is there a way to prepare for it? Or is it something you can't really prepare for?
I'd say, yeah, there's some preparation that comes with taking the polar plunge. You want to make sure that you don't wear flip-flops, for example, because you'll lose them. So make sure that you will bring, sandals that strap onto your feet, or even water shoes are a really good option, too. You want to make sure, as I said before, you bring a change of clothes and a towel, and also a plastic bag for any of your wet clothes afterwards. So just making sure that you have some of those items on you, the waiver signed, all those good things, when you're coming to the event will help the event go by a little bit easier.
Sometimes in Lake Superior, even in August, I have to work up the nerve to get in. Do you have a lot of fence sitters lingering on the shore trying to work up the nerve to get into the water?
I think there's definitely been a couple of people who maybe backed out at the last minute, but it's definitely worth it to just go the whole way, and you won't have any regrets, I promise.
Now, you said these plunges were taking place kind of all over the country, at least where it's cold enough. Is there something that makes them uniquely Wisconsin that you know of?
Well, I'd say probably here in Madison, we have a polar plunge pub, which I would say is definitely uniquely Wisconsin. We do actually have events even taking place in Southern California, if you can believe it or not. They have a polar plunge as well there. Where
doesn't count.
It doesn't, yeah, it doesn't seem quite as hard.
That's like our Lake Superior plunge. You know?
Yeah. Yep, exactly.
So when, I think you've got a whole bunch of them coming up in February, is that right?
We do, yep. We have 12 events taking place across the state. The first event starts Saturday, February the 8th, and then they run through March the 1st. And to get signed up, you can just visit SpecialOlympicsWisconsin.org.
Are you doing it again this year?
I am, yes. I'm going to do it in Green Bay.
In costume?
Yeah, I don't know. We're going to be plunging with the Fox Sports Wisconsin team, so we'll probably have matching shirts, some kind of uniform. That's what we did last year, and it was a great time.
So, Rob, a WPR Polar Plunge team,
we'll
Central Time?
We'll see you there. Oh, I feel a sniffle coming on that'll hit me full on.
Yeah, we'll definitely meet you there,
February.
Christina.
I hope to see you there. I really do.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, and good luck with the polar plunges this year.
Thank you. Have a great day.
We've been talking to Christina Harris. She's Director of Communications for Special Olympics Wisconsin. The organization is sponsoring several polar plunges around the state to raise money for Special Olympics.
If you have ever polar plunged, let us know about it. Tweet us. We are Central Time WPR on Facebook, Central Time on WPR, or by email, centraltime@WPR.org. Lots of ways to tell us your polar plunge story via the internet.
Coming up, we take a tour of the teenage brain. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.